about some desired end. Unless one is conscious and aware and has mastered the technique, the conflicts of the mind will overrule and dominate. Basically, the technique of letting go gives you the power of choice over the tendencies of mind. Instead of being at its effect, the mind is now under your mastery. It opens up freedom and the capacity for free choice. Question: I have a hard time with acceptance. What do you recommend? Answer: divert your attention to that which is really essential experientially. Some days it rains. Some days it's sunny. Some days it's cloudy. You can't change the rain, but you can put on your raincoat. You can be realistic and take the necessary steps to remain dry. There are many aspects of life you can't change, but you can let go of your expectation or need that they be different from what they are. With observation, for instance, you will notice that there is always a war going on somewhere in the world. So to be peaceful, it is necessary to accept that waging war is part of human nature and has been throughout all of recorded time. Mankind has been at war 97% of the time. Question: I realize that fear and insecurity have driven me all of my life, but it seems like those drives account for my financial success. If I learn how to surrender, will this adversely affect my income? Answer: when a lower motivation has been let go, the mind automatically replaces it with a higher feeling and a higher motivation. What's wrong with enjoying earning a living instead of being driven by fear? The same activity will continue, but now from a pleasurable space, and it will start bringing in many rewards other than just financial. Question: without guilt, won't people misbehave? Answer: similar to a previous answer, loving concern for others replaces inhibition due to guilt. The more loving we become, the more harmless we become to others and to society in general. When you are lovingly concerned for the welfare of others, your own welfare will be taken care of and covered. Question: I have a poor memory. Do you think I could learn this technique? Answer: there is nothing to memorize in learning this technique. It is simply a way of letting go. As yet, we have not heard of anyone unable to learn it. Question: sometimes I think I am letting go, and sometimes I'm not sure. I get confused. What is the problem? Answer: look at the resistances to the process of surrendering itself. Are there any negative thoughts, doubts, or feelings about your ability to do the technique? Let all of these resistances come up, accept them, and let them go. Clarify your intention to become a happier, more loving, and peaceful person. Surrender to the ultimate. Question: you've mentioned surrender at great depth as a method by which we experience ultimate reality. Can you describe what occurs? Answer: we might call it the final run. As you apply the letting go technique to every area of life, without exception, the energy of spiritual work gets stronger and stronger. There is the fixity of attention, the relentless staying with a method, no matter what is going on. Some people say, I've done spiritual work off and on for 30 years, and I'm still where I was. They've meditated a little there, prayed a little here, gone to a workshop, heard a speaker, read a book, and it has all been sporadic. That's all right. You are busy in the world and accumulating data that you know you're going to use at a later date. But then there comes a time when it means to do whatever practice you're doing without exception all the time. The devotion to the truth becomes overwhelming. It isn't that you're driving it. You're being pulled by your own destiny. It is by your own karmic commitment that you've chosen the ultimate destiny. At that point, let's say you use the technique of surrender. This means to surrender and let go of everything at the very moment it arises. It happens in 1/10,000th of a second. It's coming, it peaks, and then it leaves. So every feeling, every thought, every desire, you let go at the peak of it. This becomes continuous, non-stop. As mentioned earlier, I remember letting go of a severe attachment for 11 days, sitting and doing nothing but letting go of this attachment. Every thought, every feeling, every memory, everything about it, as it arose, it was surrendered. The grief that we feel when we lose a member of our family is not just about losing that person here and now. It's an accumulation of the energy of all the deaths from all the lifetimes. This particular surrender was non-stop for 11 days, morning and night. Finally, it stopped. Gone forever. Never again to be subject to that. So, serious spiritual work is a continuous willingness to let things go as they arise. It is the willingness to surrender wanting to control everything as it arises. The willingness to surrender wanting to change it and to have it our way. Very often, there will be illusions about the nature of reality that also have to be let go. That there's a good and a bad, a desirable and an undesirable, that's all in the mind. In reality, the sun shines and then the clouds come. The rain falls and the grass grows up and dies. The stock market goes up and down. Age comes and goes. People arise and leave. And so, there's the ebb and flow. If you are at this one point of the cycle, there's no use in crying about it, because the cycle will cycle itself out. By surrendering to whatever is cycling up, it eventually disappears. You disappear it by choosing to be one with it and refusing to want to change it as it arises. Do this continuously, no matter what, non-stop. This means that you cannot make an exception here or an exception there. It means continuously, and with everyone and everything. The one or two things you hide behind probably represent a stack. That's why you're hanging on to them. It's not just this annoying person you hate. They represent a whole stack of that energy to you. You can't just skip over your mother-in-law. Eventually, everything is surrendered that stands in the way of the presence. The presence is so obvious, so startling, so overwhelming that there's no question about it. It is profound, total, all-encompassing, absolutely overwhelming, totally transforming, and completely unmistakable. When everything is surrendered that stands in the way, it is there, shining brilliantly forth. Instead of viewing this as something in the future, own it now. Enlightenment is not something that occurs in the future after 50 years of sitting cross-legged and saying Om. It is right here, in this instant. The reason you're not experiencing this state of total peace and timelessness is because it is being resisted. It is being resisted because you are trying to control the moment. If you let go of trying to control your experience of the moment, and if you constantly surrender it like a tone of music, then you live on the crest of this exact alwaysness. Experience arises like a note of music. The minute you hear a note, it's already passing away. The instant you've heard it, it's already dissolving. So every single moment is dissolving as it arises. Let go of anticipating the next moment, trying to control it, trying to hang on to the moment that has just passed. Let go clinging to what has just occurred. Let go trying to control what you think is about to occur. Then you live in an infinite space of non-time and non-event. There is an infinite peace beyond description, and you are home. Appendix B, Muscle Testing Procedure. General information. The energy field of consciousness is infinite in dimension. Specific levels correlate with human consciousness and have been calibrated from 1 to 1,000. See Appendix A, Map of Consciousness. These energy fields reflect and dominate human consciousness. Everything in the universe radiates a specific frequency or minute energy field that remains in the field of consciousness permanently. Thus, every person or being that ever lived and anything about them, including any event, thought, deed, feeling, or attitude, is recorded forever and can be retrieved at any time in the present or the future. Technique. The muscle testing response is a simple yes or not yes, no response to a specific stimulus. It is usually done by the subject holding out an extended arm and the tester pressing down on the wrist of the extended arm using two fingers and light pressure. Usually, the subject holds a substance to be tested over their solar plexus with the other hand. The tester says to the test subject, "Resist," and if the substance being tested is beneficial to the subject, the arm will be strong. If it is not beneficial, or it has an adverse effect, the arm will go weak. The response is very quick and brief. It is important to note that the intention, as well as both the tester and the one being tested, must calibrate over 200 in order to obtain accurate responses. Experience from online discussion groups has shown that many students obtain inaccurate results. Further research shows that at calibration 200, there is still a 30% chance of error. The higher the levels of consciousness of the test team, the more accurate are the results. The best attitude is one of clinical detachment, posing a statement with the prefix statement, "In the name of the highest good," blank, calibrates as true, over 100, over 200, etc. The contextualization "in the highest good" increases accuracy because it transcends self-serving personal interest and motives. For many years, the test was thought to be a local response of the body's acupuncture or immune system. Later research, however, has revealed that the response is not a local response to the body at all, but instead is a general response of consciousness itself to the energy of a substance or a statement. That which is true, beneficial, or pro-life gives a positive response that stems from the impersonal field of consciousness, which is present in everyone living. This positive response is indicated by the body's musculature going strong. There is also an associated pupillary response. The eyes dilate with falsity and constrict to truth, as well as alterations in brain function as revealed by magnetic imaging. For convenience, the deltoid muscle is usually the one best used as an indicator muscle. However, any of the muscles of the body can be used. Before a question, in the form of a statement, is presented, it is necessary to qualify permission, that is, state, "I have permission to ask about what I am holding in mind, yes or no," or, "This calibration serves the highest good." If a statement is false or a substance is injurious, the muscles go weak quickly in response to the command, "Resist." This indicates the stimulus is negative, untrue, anti-life, or the answer is no. The response is fast and brief in duration. The body will then rapidly recover and return to normal muscle tension. There are three ways of doing the testing. The one that is used in research and also most generally used requires two people, the tester and the test subject. A quiet setting is preferred, with no background music. The test subject closes their eyes. The tester must phrase the question to be asked in the form of a statement. The statement can then be answered as yes or no by the muscle response. For instance, the incorrect form would be to ask, "Is this a healthy horse?" The correct form is to make the statement, "This horse is healthy," or its corollary, this horse is sick. After making the statement, the tester says, resist, to the test subject, who is holding the extended arm parallel to the ground. The tester presses down sharply with two fingers on the wrist of the extended arm with mild force. The test subject's arm will either stay strong, indicating a yes, or go weak, indicating a not yes, no. The response is short and immediate. A second method is the O-ring method, which can be done alone. The thumb and middle finger of the same hand are held tightly in an O configuration, and the hooked forefinger of the opposite hand is used to try to pull them apart. There is a noticeable difference in the strength between a yes and a no response. The third method is the simplest, yet, like the others, requires some practice. Simply lift a heavy object, such as a large dictionary, or merely a couple of bricks, from a table about waist high. Hold in mind an image or true statement to be calibrated, and then lift. Then, for contrast, hold in mind that which is known to be false. Note the ease of lifting when truth is held in mind, and the greater effort necessary to lift the load when the issue is false, not true. The results can be verified using the other two methods. Calibration of specific levels. The critical point between positive and negative, between true and false, or between that which is constructive or destructive, is at the calibrated level of 200, see map in Appendix A. Anything above 200, or true, makes the subject go strong. Anything below 200, or false, allows the arm to go weak. Anything past or present, including images or statements, historical events, or personages, can be tested. They need not be verbalized. Numerical calibration. Example: Ramana Maharshi's teachings calibrate over 700. Yes or no? Or, Hitler calibrated over 200. Yes or no? When he was in his 20s. Yes or no? His 30s. Yes or no? His 40s. Yes or no? At the time of his death. Yes or no? Applications. The muscle test cannot be used to foretell the future. Otherwise, there are no limits as to what can be asked. Consciousness has no limits in time or space. However, permission may be denied. All current or historical events are available for questioning. The answers are impersonal and do not depend on the belief systems of either the tester or the test subject. For example, protoplasm recoils from noxious stimuli and flesh bleeds. Those are the qualities of these test materials and are impersonal. Consciousness actually knows only truth because only truth has actual existence. It does not respond to falsehood because falsehood does not have existence in reality. It will also not respond accurately to non-integrous or egotistical questions. Accurately speaking, the test response is either an on response or merely a not-on response. Like the electrical switch, we say the electricity is on, and when we use the term off, we just mean that it is not there. In reality, there is no such thing as offness. This is a subtle statement, but crucial to the understanding of the nature of consciousness. Consciousness is capable of recognizing only truth. It merely fails to respond to falsehood. Similarly, a mirror reflects an image only if there is an object to reflect. If no object is present to the mirror, there is no reflected image. To calibrate a level. Calibrated levels are relative to a specific reference scale. To arrive at the same figures as in the chart in Appendix A, reference must be made to that table, or by a statement such as, on a scale of human consciousness from 1 to 1,000, where 600 indicates enlightenment, this blank calibrates over blank, a number. Or, on a scale of consciousness where 200 is the level of truth, and 500 is the level of love, this statement calibrates over blank. state a specific number. General information. People generally want to determine truth from falsehood. Therefore, the statement has to be made very specifically. Avoid using general terms such as a good job to apply for. Good in what way? Pay scale? Working conditions? Promotional opportunities? Fairness of the boss? Expertise. Familiarity with the test brings progressive expertise. The right questions to ask begin to spring forth and can become almost uncannily accurate. If the same tester and test subject work together for a period of time, one or both of them will develop what can become an amazing accuracy and capability of pinpointing just what specific questions to ask, even though the subject is totally unknown by either one. For instance, the tester has lost an object and begins by saying, "I left it in my office." Answer, "No." "I left it in the car." Answer, "No." All of a sudden, the test subject almost sees the object and says, "Ask on the back of the bathroom door." The test subject says, "The object is hanging on the back of the bathroom door." Answer, "Yes." In this actual case, the test subject did not even know that the tester had stopped for gas and left a jacket in the restroom of a gasoline station. Any information can be obtained about anything anywhere in current or past time or space, depending on receiving prior permission. Sometimes one gets a no, perhaps for karmic or other unknown reasons. By cross-checking, accuracy can be easily confirmed. For anyone who learns the technique, more information is available instantaneously than can be held in all the computers and libraries of the world. The possibilities are therefore obviously unlimited, and the prospects breathtaking. Limitations. The test is accurate only if the test subjects themselves calibrate over 200, and the intention for the use of the test is integrus, calibrating over 200. The requirement is one of detached objectivity and alignment with truth rather than subjective opinion. Thus, to try to prove a point negates accuracy. Approximately 10% of the population is not able to use the kinesiologic testing technique for as yet unknown reasons. Sometimes married couples, for reasons as yet undiscovered, are unable to use each other as test subjects and may have to find a third person to be a test partner. A suitable test subject is a person whose arm goes strong when a love object or person is held in mind, and it goes weak if that which is negative, fear, hate, guilt, etc., is held in mind. E.g., Winston Churchill makes one go strong, and Osama bin Laden makes one go weak. Occasionally, a suitable test subject gives paradoxical responses. This can usually be cleared by doing the thymic thump. With a closed fist, thump 3 times over the upper breastbone, smile, and say, "Ha, ha, ha," with each thump, and mentally picture someone or something that is loved. The temporary imbalance will then clear up. The imbalance may be the result of recently having been with negative people, listening to heavy metal rock music, watching violent television programs, playing violent video games, etc. Negative music energy has a deleterious effect on the energy system of the body for up to 1/2 hour after it is turned off. Television commercials or background are also a common source of negative energy. As previously noted, this method of discerning truth from falsehood and the calibrated levels of truth has strict requirements. Because of the limitations, calibrated levels are supplied for ready reference in truth versus falsehood. Explanation. The muscle strength test is independent of personal opinion or beliefs and is an impersonal response of the field of consciousness, just as protoplasm is impersonal in its responses. This can be demonstrated by the observation that the test responses are the same whether verbalized or held silently in mind. Thus, the test subject is not influenced by the question, as they do not even know what it is. To demonstrate this, do the following exercise. The tester holds in mind an image unknown to the test subject and states, "The image I am holding in mind is positive, or true, or calibrates over 200, etc." Upon direction, the test subject then resists the downward pressure on the wrists. If the tester holds a positive image in mind, e.g., Abraham Lincoln, Jesus, Mother Teresa, etc., the test subject's arm muscle will go strong. If the tester holds a false statement or negative image in mind, e.g., Bin Laden, Hitler, etc., the arm will go weak. Inasmuch as the test subject does not know what the tester has in mind, the results are not influenced by personal beliefs. Disqualification. Both skepticism, calibrated 160, and cynicism, as well as atheism, calibrate below 200 because they reflect negative prejudgment. In contrast, true inquiry requires an open mind and honesty devoid of intellectual vanity. Negative studies of the testing methodology all calibrate below 200, usually at 160, as do the investigators themselves. That even famous professors can and do calibrate below 200 may seem surprising to the average person. Thus, negative studies are a consequence of negative bias. As an example, Francis Crick's research design that led to the discovery of the double helix pattern of DNA calibrated at 440. His last research design, which was intended to prove that consciousness was just a product of neuronal activity, calibrated at only 135. He was an atheist. The failure of investigators who themselves, or by faulty research design, calibrate below 200, usually at 160, confirms the truth of the very methodology they claim to disprove. They should get negative results, and so they do, which paradoxically proves the accuracy of the test to detect the difference between unbiased integrity and non-integrity. Any new discovery may upset the apple cart and be viewed as a threat to the status quo of prevailing belief systems. That consciousness research validates spiritual reality is, of course, going to precipitate resistance, as it is actually a direct confrontation to the dominion of the narcissistic core of the ego itself, which is innately presumptuous and opinionated. Below consciousness level 200, comprehension is limited by the dominance of lower mind, which is capable of recognizing facts, but not yet able to grasp what is meant by the term truth. It confuses res interna with res externa, and that truth has physiological accompaniments that are different from falsehood. Additionally, truth is intuited, as evidenced by the use of voice analysis, the study of body language, pupillary response, EEG changes in the brain, fluctuations in breathing, and blood pressure, galvanic skin response, dowsing, and even the HUNA technique of measuring the distance that the aura radiates from the body. Some people have a very simple technique that utilizes the standing body like a pendulum, fall forward with truth and backward with falsehood. From a more advanced contextualization, the principles that prevail are that truth cannot be disproved by falsehood any more than light can be disproved by darkness. The non-linear is not subject to the limitations of the linear. Truth is a paradigm different from logic, and thus is not provable, as that which is provable calibrates only in the 400s. Consciousness research methodology operates at level 600, which is at the interface of the linear and the non-linear dimensions. Discrepancies. Differing calibrations may be obtained over time or by different investigators for a variety of reasons. 1. Situations, people, politics, policies, and attitudes change over time. 2. People tend to use different sensory modalities when they hold something in mind, i.e., visual, sensory, auditory, or feeling. Your mother could therefore be how she looked, felt, sounded, etc. Or Henry Ford could be calibrated as a father, as an industrialist, for his impact on America, his anti-Semitism, etc. 3. Accuracy increases with the level of consciousness. The 400s and above are the most accurate. One can specify context and stick to a prevailing modality. The same team, using the same technique, will get results that are internally consistent. Expertise develops with practice. There are some people, however, who are incapable of a scientific, detached attitude and are unable to be objective, and for whom the testing method will therefore not be accurate. Dedication and intention to the truth has to be given priority over personal opinions and trying to prove them as being right. Note, while it was discovered that the technique does not work for people who calibrate at less than level 200, only quite recently was it further discovered that the technique does not work if the persons doing the testing are atheists. This may be simply the consequence of the fact that atheism calibrates below level 200, and that negation of the truth or divinity, omniscience, karmically disqualifies the negator just as hate negates love. Autobiographic Note by author Dr. David R. Hawkins. While the truths reported in this book were scientifically derived and objectively organized, like all truths, they were first experienced personally. A lifelong sequence of intense states of awareness beginning at a young age first inspired and then gave direction to the process of subjective realization that has finally taken form in this series of books. At age 3, there occurred a sudden full consciousness of existence, a nonverbal but complete understanding of the meaning of I am, followed immediately by the frightening realization that I might not have come into existence at all. This was an instant awakening from oblivion into a conscious awareness, and in that moment, the personal self was born, and the duality of is and is not entered my subjective awareness. Throughout childhood and early adolescence, the paradox of existence and the question of the reality of the self remained a repeated concern. The personal self would sometimes begin slipping back into a greater impersonal self, and the initial fear of non-existence, the fundamental fear of nothingness, would recur. In 1939, as a paperboy with a 17-mile bicycle route in rural Wisconsin, on a dark winter's night, I was caught miles from home in a 20-below-zero blizzard. The bicycle fell over on the ice, and the fierce wind ripped the newspapers out of the handlebar basket, blowing them across the ice-covered snowy field. There were tears of frustration and exhaustion, and my clothes were frozen stiff. To get out of the wind, I broke through the icy crust of a high snowbank, dug out a space, and crawled into it. Soon the shivering stopped, and there was a delicious warmth, and then a state of peace beyond all description. This was accompanied by a suffusion of light and a presence of infinite love that had no beginning and no end and was undifferentiated from my own essence. The physical body and surroundings faded as my awareness was fused with this all-present illuminated state. The mind grew silent, all thought stopped. An infinite presence was all that was or could be, beyond all time or description. After that timelessness, there was suddenly an awareness of someone shaking my knee. Then my father's anxious face appeared. There was great reluctance to return to the body and all that that entailed. But because of my father's love and anguish, the spirit nurtured and reactivated the body. There was compassion for his fear of death, although at the same time, the concept of death seemed absurd. This subjective experience was not discussed with anyone, since there was no context available from which to describe it. It was not common to hear of spiritual experiences other than those reported in the lives of the saints. But after this experience, the accepted reality of the world began to seem only provisional. Traditional religious teachings lost significance, and paradoxically, I became an agnostic. Compared to the light of divinity that had illuminated all existence, the God of traditional religion shone dully indeed. Thus spirituality replaced religion. During World War II, hazardous duty on a minesweeper often brought close brushes with death, but there was no fear of it. It was as though death had lost its authenticity. After the war, fascinated by the complexities of the mind and wanting to study psychiatry, I worked my way through medical school. My training psychoanalyst, a professor at Columbia University, was also an agnostic. We both took a dim view of religion. The analysis went well, as did my career, and success followed. I did not, however, settle quietly into professional life. I fell ill with a progressive, fatal illness that did not respond to any treatments available. By age 38, I was in extremis and knew I was about to die. I didn't care about the body, but my spirit was in a state of extreme anguish and despair. As the final moment approached, the thought flashed through my mind, what if there is a God? So I called out in prayer, if there is a God, I ask him to help me now. I surrendered to whatever God there might be and went into oblivion. When I awoke, a transformation of such enormity had taken place that I was struck dumb with awe. The person I had been no longer existed. There was no personal self or ego, only an infinite presence of such unlimited power that it was all that was. This presence had replaced what had been me, and the body and its actions were controlled solely by the infinite will of the presence. The world was illuminated by the clarity of an infinite oneness that expressed itself as all things revealed in their infinite beauty and perfection. As life went on, this stillness persisted. There was no personal will. The physical body went about its business under the direction of the infinitely powerful but exquisitely gentle will of the presence. In that state, there was no need to think about anything. All truth was self-evident, and no conceptualization was necessary or even possible. At the same time, the physical nervous system felt extremely overtaxed, as though it were carrying far more energy than its circuits had been designed for. It was not possible to function effectively in the world. All ordinary motivations had disappeared, along with all fear and anxiety. There was nothing to seek, as all was perfect. Fame, success, and money were meaningless. Friends urged the pragmatic return to clinical practice, but there was no ordinary motivation to do so. There was now the ability to perceive the reality that underlay personalities. The origin of emotional sickness lay in people's belief that they were their personalities. And so, as though of its own, a clinical practice resumed and eventually became huge. People came from all over the United States. The practice had 2,000 outpatients, which required more than 50 therapists and other employees, a suite of 25 offices, and research and electroencephalic laboratories. There were 1,000 new patients a year. In addition, there were appearances on radio and network television shows, as previously mentioned. In 1973, the clinical research was documented in a traditional format in the book Orthomolecular Psychiatry. This work was 10 years ahead of its time and created something of a stir. The overall condition of the nervous system improved slowly, and then another phenomenon commenced. There was a sweet, delicious band of energy continuously flowing up the spine and into the brain, where it created an intense sensation of continuous pleasure. Everything in life happened by synchronicity, evolving in perfect harmony. The miraculous was commonplace. The origin of what the world would call miracles was the presence, not the personal self. What remained of the personal me was only a witness to these phenomena. The greater I, deeper than my former self or thoughts, determined all that happened. the states that were present had been reported by others throughout history and led to the investigation of spiritual teachings, including those of the Buddha, enlightened sages, Huang Po, and more recent teachers such as Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj. It was thus confirmed that these experiences were not unique. The Bhagavad Gita now made complete sense. At times, the same spiritual ecstasy reported by Sri Ramakrishna and the Christian saints occurred. Everything and everyone in the world was luminous and exquisitely beautiful. All living beings became radiant and expressed this radiance in stillness and splendor. It was apparent that all mankind is actually motivated by inner love, but has simply become unaware. Most lives are lived as though by sleepers, unawakened to the awareness of who they really are. People around me looked as though they were asleep and were incredibly beautiful. It was like being in love with everyone. It was necessary to stop the habitual practice of meditating for an hour in the morning and then again before dinner, because it would intensify the bliss to such an extent that it was not possible to function. An experience similar to the one that had occurred in the snowbank as a boy would recur, and it became increasingly difficult to leave that state and return to the world. The incredible beauty of all things shone forth in all their perfection, and where the world saw ugliness, there was only timeless beauty. This spiritual love suffused all perception and all boundaries between here and there, or then and now, or separation, disappeared. During the years spent in inner silence, the strength of the presence grew. Life was no longer personal. A personal will no longer existed. The personal I had become an instrument of the infinite presence and went about and did as it was willed. People felt an extraordinary peace in the aura of that presence. Seekers sought answers, but as there was no longer any such individual as David, they were actually finessing answers from their own self, which was not different from mine. From each person, the same self shone forth from their eyes. The miraculous happened, beyond ordinary comprehension. Many chronic maladies from which the body had suffered for years disappeared. Eyesight spontaneously normalized, and there was no longer a need for the lifetime bifocals. Occasionally, an exquisitely blissful energy, an infinite love, would suddenly begin to radiate from the heart toward the scene of some calamity. Once, while driving on a highway, this exquisite energy began to beam out of the chest. As the car rounded a bend, there was an auto accident. The wheels of the overturned car were still spinning. The energy passed with great intensity into the occupants of the car, and then stopped of its own accord. Another time, while I was walking on the streets of a strange city, the energy started to flow down the block ahead and arrived at the scene of an incipient gang fight. The combatants fell back and began to laugh, and again the energy stopped. Profound changes of perception came without warning in improbable circumstances. While dining alone at Rothman's on Long Island, the presence suddenly intensified until everything and every person which had appeared as separate in ordinary perception melted into a timeless universality and oneness. In the motionless silence, it became obvious that there are no events or things, and that nothing actually happens, because past, present, and future are merely artifacts of perception, as is the illusion of a separate I being subject to birth and death. As the limited false self dissolved into the universal self of its true origin, there was an ineffable sense of having returned home to a state of absolute peace and relief from all suffering. It is only the illusion of individuality that is the origin of all suffering. When one realizes that one is the universe, complete and at one with all that is, forever without end, then no further suffering is possible. Patients came from every country in the world, and some were the most hopeless of the hopeless. Grotesque, Writhing, wrapped in wet sheets for transport from faraway hospitals, they came, hoping for treatment for advanced psychoses and grave, incurable mental disorders. Some were catatonic. Many had been mute for years. But in each patient, beneath the crippled appearance, there was the shining essence of love and beauty, perhaps so obscured to ordinary vision that he or she had become totally unloved in this world. One day, a mute catatonic was brought into the hospital in a straitjacket. She had a severe neurological disorder and was unable to stand. Squirming on the floor, she went into spasms, and her eyes rolled back in her head. Her hair was matted. She had torn all her clothes and uttered guttural sounds. Her family was fairly wealthy. As a result, over the years, she had been seen by innumerable physicians and famous specialists from all over the world. Every treatment had been tried on her, and she had been given up as hopeless by the medical profession. A short, nonverbal question arose. What do you want done with her, God? Then came the realization that she just needed to be loved. That was all. Her inner self shone through her eyes, and the self connected with that loving essence. In that second, she was healed by her own recognition of who she really was. What happened to her mind or body did not matter to her any longer. This, in essence, occurred with countless patients. Some recovered in the eyes of the world, and some did not. But whether a clinical recovery ensued did not matter any longer to the patients. Their inner agony was over. As they felt loved and at peace within, their pain stopped. This phenomenon can only be explained by saying that the compassion of the presence recontextualized each patient's reality so that he or she experienced healing on a level that transcended the world and its appearances. The inner peace of the self encompassed us beyond time and identity. It was clear that all pain and suffering arises solely from the ego and not from God. This truth was silently communicated to the minds of the patients. This was the mental block in another mute catatonic who had not spoken in many years. The self said to him through mind, "You're blaming God for what your ego has done to you." He jumped off the floor and began to speak, much to the shock of the nurse who witnessed the incident. The work became increasingly taxing and eventually overwhelming. Patients were backed up, waiting for beds to open, although the hospital had built an extra ward to house them. There was an enormous frustration in that the human suffering could be countered in only one patient at a time. It was like bailing out the sea. It seemed that there must be some other way to address the causes of the common malaise, the endless stream of spiritual distress and human suffering. This led to the study of the physiological response, muscle testing, to various stimuli, which revealed an amazing discovery. It was the wormhole between two universes, the physical world and the world of the mind and spirit, an interface between dimensions. In a world full of sleepers, lost from their source, here was a tool to recover and demonstrate for all to see that lost connection with the higher reality. This led to the testing of every substance, thought, and concept that could be brought to mind. The endeavor was aided by my students and research assistants. Then a major discovery was made. Whereas all subjects went weak from negative stimuli, such as fluorescent lights, pesticides, and artificial sweeteners, students of spiritual disciplines who had advanced their levels of awareness did not go weak, as did ordinary people. Something important and decisive had shifted in their consciousness. It apparently occurred as they realized they were not at the mercy of the world, but rather affected only by what their minds believed. Perhaps the very process of progress toward enlightenment could be shown to increase man's ability to resist the vicissitudes of existence, including illness. The self had the capacity to change things in the world by merely envisioning them. Love changed the world each time it replaced non-love. The entire scheme of civilization could be profoundly altered by focusing this power of love at a very specific point. Whenever this happened, history bifurcated down new roads. It now appeared that these crucial insights could not only be communicated with the world, but also visibly and irrefutably demonstrated. It seemed that the great tragedy of human life had always been that the psyche is so easily deceived. Discord and strife have been the inevitable consequence of mankind's inability to distinguish the false from the true. But here was an answer to this fundamental dilemma, a way to recontextualize the nature of consciousness itself and make explicable that which otherwise could only be inferred. It was time to leave life in New York, with its city apartment and home on Long Island, for something more important. It was necessary to perfect myself as an instrument. This necessitated leaving that world and everything in it, replacing it with a reclusive life in a small town where the next 7 years were spent in meditation and study. Overpowering states of bliss returned unsought, and eventually there was the need to learn how to be in the divine presence and still function in the world. The mind had lost track of what was happening in the world at large. In order to do research and writing, it was necessary to stop all spiritual practice and focus on the world of form. Reading the newspaper and watching television helped to catch up on the story of who was who, the major events, and the nature of the current social dialogue. Exceptional subjective experiences of truth, which are the province of the mystic who affects all mankind by sending forth spiritual energy into the collective consciousness, are not understandable by the majority of mankind, and are therefore of limited meaning except to other spiritual seekers. This led to an effort to be ordinary, because just being ordinary in itself is an expression of divinity. The truth of one's real self can be discovered through the pathway of everyday life. To live with care and kindness is all that is necessary. The rest reveals itself in due time. The commonplace and God are not distinct. And so, after a long circular journey of the spirit, there was a return to the most important work, which was to try to bring the presence at least a little closer to the grasp of as many fellow beings as possible. The presence is silent and conveys a state of peace that is the space in which and by which all is and has its existence and experience. It is infinitely gentle and yet like a rock. With it, all fear disappears. Spiritual joy occurs on a quiet level of inexplicable ecstasy. Because the experience of time stops, there is no apprehension or regret, no pain or anticipation. The source of joy is unending and ever-present. With no beginning or ending, there is no loss or grief or desire. Nothing needs to be done. Everything is already perfect and complete. When time stops, all problems disappear. They are merely artifacts of a point of perception. As the presence prevails, there is no further identification with the body or the mind. When the mind grows silent, the thought, "I am," also disappears, and pure awareness shines forth to illuminate what one is, was, and always will be, beyond all worlds and all universes, beyond time, and therefore without beginning or end. People wonder, how does one reach this state of awareness? But few follow the steps because they are so simple. First, the desire to reach that state was intense. Then began the discipline to act with constant and universal forgiveness and gentleness without exception. One has to be compassionate towards everything, including one's own self and thoughts. Next came a willingness to hold desires in abeyance and surrender personal will at every moment. As each thought, feeling, desire or deed was surrendered to God, the mind became progressively silent. At first, it released whole stories and paragraphs, then ideas and concepts. As one lets go of wanting to own these thoughts, they no longer reach such elaboration and begin to fragment while only half-formed. Finally, it was possible to turn over the energy behind thought itself before it even became thought. The task of constant and unrelenting fixity of focus, allowing not even a moment of distraction from meditation, continued while doing ordinary activities. At first, this seemed very difficult, but as time went on, it became habitual, automatic, requiring less and less effort, and finally, it was effortless. The process is like a rocket leaving the earth. At first, it requires enormous power, then less and less, as it leaves the earth's gravitational field, and finally, it moves through space under its own momentum. Suddenly, without warning, a shift in awareness occurred, and the presence was there, unmistakable and all-encompassing. There were a few moments of apprehension as the self died, and then the absoluteness of the presence inspired a flash of awe. This breakthrough was spectacular, more intense than anything before. It has no counterpart in ordinary experience. The profound shock was cushioned by the love that is with the presence. Without the support and protection of that love, one would be annihilated. There followed a moment of terror as the ego clung to its existence, fearing it would become nothingness. Instead, as it died, it was replaced by the self as everythingness, the all in which everything is known and obvious in its perfect expression of its own existence. With non-locality came the awareness that one is all that ever was or can be. One is total and complete, beyond all identities, beyond all gender, beyond even humanness itself. One need never again fear suffering and death. What happens to the body from this point is immaterial. At certain levels of spiritual awareness, ailments of the body heal or spontaneously disappear. But in the absolute state, such considerations are irrelevant. The body will run its predicted course and then return from whence it came. It is a matter of no importance. One is unaffected. The body appears as an it rather than as a me, as another object, like the furniture in a room. It may seem comical that people still address the body as though it were the individual you, but there is no way to explain this state of awareness to the unaware. It is best to just go on about one's business and allow providence to handle the social adjustments. However, as one reaches bliss, it is very difficult to conceal that state of intense ecstasy. The world may be dazzled, and people may come from far and wide to be in the accompanying aura. Spiritual seekers and the spiritually curious may be attracted, as may be the very ill who are seeking miracles. One may become a magnet and a source of joy to them. Commonly, there is a desire at this point to share this state with others and to use it for the benefit of all. The ecstasy that accompanies this condition is not initially absolutely stable. There are also moments of great agony. The most intense occur when the state fluctuates and suddenly ceases, for no apparent reason. These times bring on periods of intense despair and a fear that one has been forsaken by the presence. These falls make the path arduous, and to surmount these reversals requires great will. It finally becomes obvious that one must transcend this level or constantly suffer excruciating descents from grace. The glory of ecstasy, then, has to be relinquished as one enters upon the arduous task of transcending duality until one is beyond all opposites and their conflicting pulls. But while it is one thing to happily give up the iron chains of the ego, it is quite another to abandon the golden chains of ecstatic joy. It feels as though one is giving up God, and a new level of fear arises, never before anticipated. This is the final terror of absolute aloneness. To the ego, the fear of non-existence was formidable, and it drew back from it repeatedly as it seemed to approach. The purpose of the agonies and the dark nights of the soul then became apparent. They are so intolerable that their exquisite pain spurs one on to the extreme effort required to surmount them. When vacillation between heaven and hell becomes unendurable, the desire for existence itself has to be surrendered. Only once this is done may one finally move beyond the duality of allness versus nothingness, beyond existence versus non-existence. This culmination of the inner work is the most difficult phase, the ultimate watershed, where one is starkly aware that the illusion of existence one transcends is irrevocable. There is no returning from this step, and this specter of irreversibility makes this last barrier appear to be the most formidable choice of all. But in fact, in this final apocalypse of the self, the dissolution of the sole remaining duality of existence versus non-existence, identity itself, dissolves in universal divinity, and no individual consciousness is left to choose. The last step, then, is taken by God. David R. Hawkins. To find out more about the author, or any other Hay House authors, or the Hay Foundation, please visit hayhouse.com. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.